This talk is about endurance because I have a ton of material to cover. I won't be finished within the hour, which is why I'm the last talker today. So, stay as long as you can, and let's get into it. We're going to talk about some illegal stuff. I don't endorse doing illegal stuff. These are topics today, and, one of them we're going to barely touch on, and the others we're going to go into in depth. The one we're going to barely touch on is competitive intelligence. And basically, competitive intelligence is using legal means to gather information to help businesses make sound business decisions. It's based on market research. You find out who your competitors are, your suppliers, location of your business, distribution channels. And basically, all the information that companies need to compete successfully is in the public domain. And there's a link to many links of many resources to do competitive intelligence. This is basically all legal stuff, so we're going to focus on illegal stuff, so I'm not going to get into this anymore. Corporate espionage. Espionage, the collection of illegally gained information. And corporate espionage is the theft of trade secrets. And trade secrets has a huge definition. It covers, all forms and types of financial, business, scientific, technical, economic, or engineering information, including patents, plans, compilations, program devices, formulas, designs, prototypes, methods, techniques, processes, procedures, programs, or codes, whether tangible or intangible, and whether or how stored, blah, blah, blah. My brief definition is it's a property right that has value because your competitors don't know the secret. According to the International Trade Commission, annual losses to U.S. businesses because of corporate espionage is about $70 billion. According to the American Society of Industrial Security, in 1997, U.S. businesses may have lost over $300 billion in intellectual property or trade secrets. That's basically because that was a year when a lot of companies were getting on the net. They didn't really know what to protect themselves against, and corporate espionage had its heyday that year. Here's a few examples of the hundreds of examples of corporate espionage. I briefly ran a information security consulting firm, and we actually saw some specific examples where companies came to us and former employees or former business partners were now competing against them and were committing corporate espionage against these companies. These are some of the bigger ones, and there are many more examples. Intel designs given to AMD by an employee, corrupt scientists given production processes and other secrets to foreign companies, and some former executive of GM giving box loads of highly confidential information to his new employer, Volkswagen. How is corporate espionage generally carried out? Basically inside jobs, 70% more or less, involve insiders. Basically it's a lot of times disgruntled employees taking bribes from a competitor. Or industrial moles being planted within a company to steal secrets. And also another method, just false pretenses, people hiring a competitor's employee just to get the information that they have from their former company, or interviewing with a company just to pump them for information, or pretending to be, say, a venture capitalist. So you go to some company and say, I've got a lot of money. I might invest it in your company, but I want you to tell me everything about your company, and gathering information that way. So the inside job is the most damaging. the insider is going to get logical system access, authorized system access, and they're also going to have physical access to desks, servers, shredding bins where, you know, the most sensitive documents are kept. So, picking a lock is pretty quick. There are some talks here on lock picking. And an insider can really do a lot of damage copying information in many ways and walking out with it. Who's doing corporate espionage? Foreign governments and corporations, as well as U.S. corporations. According to the FBI, 57 nations are actively targeting U.S. corporations. There are professional industrial spies. There are members of the Society for Competitive Intelligence Professionals. Now, these people do competitive intelligence, legal stuff, but some of them will cross the line if you give them a little extra money. Consultants, hackers, these are the people who are committing corporate espionage. By the way, the U.S. government officially does not participate. Okay. What kind of information is useful to an attacker? Information on the structure of an organization, their infrastructure, their IT diagrams, their phone directories, email address books, where the offices are geographically, what are their security controls, and what types of technology do they have that an attacker would want to try to get into. Much of this information is going to aid in social engineering attacks, and other parts of it is going to aid in direct hacking attacks. So the insider threat is pretty cut and dried. You have access to systems, authorized access, and you have physical access. You're inside the organization. So I think that's pretty easy to understand how that can be very successful and very damaging. That other 30% of corporate espionage is from the outside. And we're going to discuss a basic external methodology for doing corporate espionage. And it involves public intelligence, which is very similar to the competitive intelligence, some social engineering, physical security checks, network analysis, and then direct information system attacks. An attacker who's going to employ such a methodology would typically keep notes of every single step, everything they do as they go through this process, because they may, you know, no matter how trivial the information is, it can't be overlooked, because later on they may need some of the information from some of the earlier steps to help them out in some of the later steps. I think most of you are familiar with the cuckoo's egg. Marcus Hess kept very meticulous notes of everything he was doing, and he did it for a good reason. Initial public intelligence, an attacker would hit some meta search engines, hit the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, EDGAR database. All publicly traded companies have a company portfolio. Anybody can get access to it. Patent and Trade Office has information on what companies are, what's their technology secrets that they're working on, what they have patented so far and are likely to be working on in the future, those types of things. Gathering names of individuals in the company for later social engineering attacks. Gathering phone numbers both to make social engineering attacks and to do some war dialing. And finding out who their IT suppliers are to determine what their IT infrastructure exists of, and hitting news groups and web boards and stuff like that. I've seen on news groups and web boards company user IDs, passwords, firewall packet filters, operating system information, patch levels, people's names, phone numbers. It's pretty amazing what some people will post out there when they need some help. And it's good fodder for somebody who wants to use that information to attack the organization. Also, besides those things, an attacker would go back to the links from the competitive intelligence slide and do, you know, every other thing that's listed there. There are a lot of links for getting intelligence on businesses in the public domain. A little social engineering, generally done remotely, because remotely I can pretend to be a female or someone of an ethnic origin other than mine and get away with it a lot better with a little voice manipulation than I could in person. I couldn't really successfully pretend to be a woman in person. Obviously you have to be good at lying, and you have to be motivated. That's what I found out about social engineering. It was something that I was never interested in and thought I would be horrible at, but because I'm actually not motivated to do it. But I found myself in a couple of situations where I suddenly had a little motivation, and it was pretty effective. When you're really motivated to pull off some bullshit story, it works. Some examples of doing social engineering: hit up the administrative personnel pretending to be a privileged person, hit them up over telephone, fax, email, snail mail, chat boards, whatever, and pretend to be a manager or an auditor or a law enforcement person and basically demand access to the system. Also, hit up the administrative personnel as a non-privileged person, a confused end user or a new contractor, somebody who's in help, I need help, and see if they'll give you some access. And invite people from the company to external business functions and, over drinks or in a strip club and slip them a Mickey, whatever, and see what you can learn from them. Besides the social engineering, physical security analysis, getting into an organization is going to yield you a lot of benefits if you're trying to commit corporate espionage. So an attacker would identify the physical and electronically monitored access points, the coverages, and the routes, see what kind of alarm equipment is in place, what triggers it, and who responds to it and how they respond. Identify ways they can get into the facility, whether it's through a side or back door, under or over a fence, parachute in, dig a tunnel, break some locks, whatever it takes. Identify weaknesses in the location. If you can get a line of sight into an organization and they have windows that you can view into with some high-powered viewing equipment, you might be able to get into their boardroom meetings and see what diagrams they're drawing up and what kinds of plans they're doing, or see what people are typing on their screen and capture that, record it. You may also be able to record audio based on problems with how they're set up. See who their supply personnel is in case you want to socially engineer and get inside as one of those types. And see what the possibilities are for dumpster diving. And once someone's done this physical security analysis, they can exploit the weaknesses they found, get inside and actually start stealing tapes or documents or whatever, or setting up monitoring equipment to surreptitiously monitor the organization from then on. Okay, so moving on from the physical analysis to the network analysis, and this is probably types of techniques that are fairly familiar to a lot of people here at this conference. Find out what the company's domain name is, get their IP blocks and subdomains, find out what their DNS servers are, start doing zone transfers, look at their public web server source code, see what kind of information you can gather there, and send some messages and see what bounces back and what gateways sent it back. And P2P services, person to person, this is becoming a big entry point into companies because in years back, the only people doing P2P were the Uber geeks. Now everybody's sharing music and porn and everything else over the internet with P2P services, and a lot of people are doing it on their high bandwidth work networks. And they're putting their music files and whatever else in their, like, My Documents folder along with their company, sensitive documents. So they get online and, you find these entry points and just start taking other things other than music. So, more network survey. War dialing. War games came out in, 1983 or something like that. Those techniques are still very effective today. Find modem-enabled workstations and fax machines and start rerouting faxes or just use the weakly protected modem-enabled system to get inside the network. Randomize your war dial to avoid detection. Check for default authentication, easily guess passwords, and see if you can get into their PBX system. If you can, do like silent monitoring or three-way calling or call forwarding, and maybe gain some sensitive information on the organization. And pin hack the voice mailboxes and listen to messages that may be sensitive left for managers or whoever. IP port scanning, do a broadcast ping. It's like a freight train. There's nothing stealthy about it, but it'll yield a lot of data typically. Try and DNS connect on all hosts you can identify, not just the ones that come back from the dig, because some of those may be DNS servers and give you more information on machines in their network. Use firewalking to see what kinds of protocols you can get through their firewall. Firewalking involves using ICMP, TTLs, and a modified version of Traceroute to identify the gateway and TCP or UDP connections you can make beyond the gateway. And there's a tool available to do it. Do NetBIOS scans on the network. That'll give you machine names, usernames, MAC addresses, security settings. Do ACK packet scans. Set yourself up as source port 80 and send it to a typical web destination port, and you'll find systems that can access the web, systems or proxies, and may be able to be accessed backwards. The ACK scans will return RST packets, and basically you can check the TTL in the window field and see if it's an open port. Send FIN, null, and XMIS scans using fragmented packets in random order. And you send it to like FTP, Secure Shell, Telnet, SMTP, and web services. And if you get an RST response, the port is closed. If you get no response, the port is open. So it's a type of inverse mapping. The null scans have no flags set on the packets, and the XMIS scans have all flags set. It's a method of trying to get through firewalls. If you send packet fragments, you may also get through firewalls, but you may also crash systems using packet fragments. More port scanning. Do SYN scans on those same applications, and if you get a SYN ACK response, those ports are open. Instead of completing the three-way handshake, you would send a reset packet to tear down the connection. So you may avoid detection by some simplistic IDSs. And send TCP fragments to popular application ports like SQLNet, SAP, Citrix, MS SQL, whatever. Do UDP scans and to a lot of popular applications, and if you get no response on a UDP scan, the port is open. If you get an ICMP port unreachable, the port is closed. Use banner grabbing, fingerprinting techniques to identify operating systems and applications. And once you've got all this information, you can infer what services or protocols or applications are running on those systems. More network analysis. See what kind of information you can get in HTML forms and HTML comments. See what kind of information you can get from application banners, error messages. See what kind of useful information comes back in cookies when you connect to websites. See what's in the cache, and start hitting wireless access points. We all know that wireless networks are becoming very prevalent. Okay, so once you've gone through this basic methodology, then an attacker would do actual information system attacks using, you know, well-known exploits against the applications identified. You know, just start attacking the systems, try backdoors into the operating system, the databases, or the applications. Grab their SAMs or their Etsy password or their security master file and start doing brute force attacks on it. Try and get, you know, if you get documents that are password protected, they're easy to crack and you may get reusable passwords from those. Capture and replay authentication credentials over the wire and attack printers to route prints back to your network. I was working at the Space and Naval Warfare Systems Command in San Diego, and some guy sent a job to a printer and was taking unusually long to print, and he went to check on it and turns out the print was being routed to Russia. So printers are pretty easy to hack into, and it's a pretty effective way of getting some small documents. More information system attacks. Use directory traversal to attack web applications. Find buffer overflows and send commands to those systems to exploit those buffer overflows. Use cross-site scripting attacks to execute commands on those systems. And manipulate session cookies or refer host fields to attack web applications that require authentication. So, web applications will use cookies to allow you access to their site, or they will check refer host fields. And this is kind of similar to what IDENTD does with SOCKS, where it just needs one value to allow you access to the site. And a lot of times you can figure out what they're expecting, and you can manipulate the client to send what they're expecting. Or you can, you know, send a null refer host and maybe get into the system. Exploit trusted system relationships, start getting the data. That's, you know, a basic rundown of how somebody, an outsider, would try and attack an organization. Can organizations stop corporate espionage? Well, it's pretty tough, but if they identify what their intellectual property is, what their trade secrets are, and put adequate access controls on them, that's a good start. Don't ignore expert advice. Educate the employees about protecting that information. Get an adequate security budget. Have people sign non-disclosure agreements. That's not that effective, but it will give you some protection for the basic slips of information that are inadvertent. Test all security areas routinely, physical, logical, social, whatever, and sweep your organization for surveillance equipment. Now we're going to move on to information warfare. Information warfare is basically electronic information attacks taken to support a national military strategy, and it's meant to affect enemy systems and information systems and protecting our own information systems. It includes electronic warfare, which is like jamming communication links, surveillance systems, precision strikes, being a logic bomb or something like that, or advanced battlefield management, and it's basically using information to base military decisions during a war. Who's doing this kind of stuff? Foreign governments, these and others. Ex-Cold War spies, there were a lot of people put out of work when the Cold War ended, and they've become professional hackers. There are PhDs in computer science, and these are the most dangerous of adversaries because they've got government backing, and they're intelligent, and there's high stakes involved because you're talking about losses in human life when you're dealing with this kind of situation. The United States Air Force, Army, and Navy have information warfare centers, and they are conducting war games, both offensively and defensively, on a routine basis now. Here are some information warfare categories. Offensive, deny, corrupt, or destroy an adversary's information. Exploit the available information to enhance the nation's decision cycle and disrupt the adversaries, and do information warfare hardening as a defensive measure. Cyber warfare or information warfare. In the United States, more than 95% of military communications are conducted over commercial systems. Phone, fax, internet, the NipperNet, the SipperNet, and some satellites are over public communications links. An increasing amount of technology is being used today to fight wars, whether it's unmanned attack systems or cyber-enabled warfighters. The military information decisions that are driving joint task warfare decisions or via personnel and technical applications that discuss assets, logistics, and strategy. The Department of Defense is becoming very application-enabled to conduct war. So today's targets and their risks are drastically different than those of past years because of the information age. So where might this be going? This isn't too far off of a scenario. Menu-driven warfare is, hey, let's attack somebody. Enter your selection. Some cyber warfare techniques. Initiate virus attacks on your enemy, intercept their transmissions, implant code and just start collecting data, destroy their network with worms, modify their television or radio signals to conduct psychological warfare, and misdirect their radar to where they're seeing things that aren't there or not seeing things that are there. Aggregate pieces of information from many different sources. Basically, in my past, I've done things where you do data sensitivity studies, then you start collecting thousands of data elements and putting them together in these matrices and seeing what kind of intelligence you can infer when you put these different data elements together and whether or not that becomes classified information or not. And you can, you know, maybe attack a lot of different systems that yield a little bit of data, but if you put it all together, it could yield a lot. You know, suddenly you could see the big picture, and it could be a dangerous thing. Send disinformation to the enemy, DOS, their communication networks, penetrate their intelligence systems, modify their maintenance systems so their whole infrastructure goes to hell, and screw with their logistics systems. That's what information warfare is all about. In the post 9/11 world, we have to deal with techno-terrorists these days, terrorists who are going to use technology to conduct attacks. Here's just three different definitions of terrorism: FBI, CIA, and Department of Defense. The important thing is that terrorists and foreign governments are actively planning attacks on U.S. critical infrastructure components. There have been numerous reports over the past 8 years that show China's been doing a lot of work in this area. Some of that has come out in the public, and some of it's still classified information. And basically, these attacks are planned to support a national military strategy or just turn the general quality of life of U.S. citizens to crap. What types of things would a techno-terrorist do? And these are totally hypothetical, but these are things that the U.S. has to think about in protecting themselves. You know, get into air traffic control systems and use it to start crashing planes. Hack into credit card systems and use those credit card numbers to finance their illegal operations. Get into those same systems and start diverting money to finance their activities. Use clone cell phones and computers and encryption to communicate. They might get into hospital records and change things around to where people get bad medicine and bad things happen. Techno-terrorists could use viruses and worms to destroy critical government computer systems, reroute trains to have them crash, take over to telecommunications links, take over the satellite links, just broadcast a stronger signal and get their message to our people. And, you know, what's most likely, just disrupt U.S. critical infrastructure components, things that we take for granted that'll be there every day. So is this really information warfare? This is terrorist activities. Well, yeah, because without information and intelligence, terrorists would not be able to take out these kinds of attacks successfully. And these are the kind of things that prompted the creation of the NIPC and InfraGuard and the Homeland Security Office. Private investigation. This isn't something I was going to talk about, but Dark Tangent asked me to include it in this talk. I'm not a PI and don't want to be. But private investigation is basically doing research on a subject and tying pieces of information up to that subject. And typical uses are locate missing people, spy on your spouse or your friend or your enemy. If you're adopted, locate your birth parents, or evaluate prospective employers or business partners, or police will use it to investigate suspects. These are the general personal identifiers that one needs to have some pieces of to conduct a personal investigation. You can't start an investigation saying, you know, I just want to investigate some guy, you know, and he's just a guy. You need some information to start with to collect more information on that person. And these are the typical things you would want to collect on a person to do further analysis. How would you carry out this investigation? Write down everything you know about the subject. Don't discount any piece of information, no matter how trivial or small it seems. Start from where the person lives and just start working out from there. Find out past addresses. If they're not at that address, you know, where they're at, where they moved to. And, you know, ask their neighbors for information. And also, more investigation methods, you would interview all of these people or as many of these people as you could locate that are tied to that person. And, you know, you may not get answers from many of these people when you start asking questions about the subject, but, you know, it could yield a lot for a private investigator. And obviously a little identity spoofing would help along these lines, a little social engineering. What kind of questions would an investigator typically ask? How long have you known the subject? What kind of work do they do? What's their spouse's name? Who did they hang out with? Where were they born? These are things that typical investigators ask. What organizations they belong to, who worked around their house that you might be able to interview later, what church do they go to, what are their hobbies, what kind of property do they own, are they having problems with drugs, alcohol, marriage, or money, and like, where is this person? You would then go on to hit public records resources, and we're going to go through all those public records resources in the next few slides, and also establish surveillance on a subject. So we have three types of private investigation. You have your human intelligence, you have your online intelligence, and you have your surveillance. And we're going to talk about some surveillance tools and techniques. Online resources that you can get information on people, yourself or others. Here's a bunch of links of information that anybody can get to and start doing research on a subject. And I'm not going to discuss each of those links. Yes? No. Like half my slides are on the CD, but my email address is on the first slide. And if you send me an email, I will tell you like where you can download the whole thing from. So, I mean, my email address is vvandal@well.com. So, yeah, I mean, there's too much information to take in notes, but certainly I encourage you to look at some of this later if you're interested in the subject. Here are some more links. And then you go into your information services. These services can give you information not typically available to the general public, except for your own information. So you can go to these. There are hundreds of these services, but these are the big ones. I mean, if you want to get right to the source and get the most information on someone, these can do consolidated searches or comprehensive searches of all national databases and produce a comprehensive report. You don't have to just get information. All you need is money. You go to them and you say, I want information on my neighbor or my coworker or whatever. And, give them the money and they will give you as much information as you want. Subscriptions to these services are typically $25 a month, and then you have low per search fees. So you pay like low fees besides the monthly fee. I dug around a little bit and I found some simple search options on people on non-public information, non-generally public information, for like $4 a search with no monthly fee. But you didn't get a big comprehensive report. You just got a little bit of information. And that Merlin one is probably the cheapest and works well. So what types of information is available on you and every other private citizen? This type, that's a wealth of information that a person can get on you anytime they want. So you don't have to be a police officer or a private investigator or anything else, which is a bad thing. Also, besides the personal information, an important part of personal investigation is credit checks. And here are the three national credit reporting services and the typical cost for getting credit reports on people. $70 for an annual subscription and like $10 for a one-time search. Some more online resources. That first link has, you know, hundreds of links on people searches, category searches, and fee-based services and private investigation services. And also there's a bunch of popular free or cheap search links. And there are hundreds, but these are the popular ones. Like I said, cheap. Here's some Department of Justice databases, and access to these databases requires some special authorization or some extreme social engineering or hacking. These are typically available to law enforcement personnel, but all of these systems hold data on private citizens, and through the Freedom of Information Act, you can go query all these on yourself. Or you can spoof your identity and get information on other people. But these are important to know about, that they exist and what they are and what types of information are in there. Here's some more of them. So this is something people probably are interested in. Are you under investigation? Are you a target? Well, if your garbage disappears, this actually happened to me. Years back, I woke up, it's about 3:30 in the morning, just woke up and had cotton mouth and wanted a sip of water. I walked to my kitchen, walked to the sink and started to get a glass of water. And I see this sedan pull up in front of my house. The trunk pops open. A guy jumps out the passenger side, opens my garbage can, grabs my garbage, throws it in the trunk, closes it, and speeds off. And I'm like, what the hell is that? I lived in a small town outside of a big city, and it didn't look like the local law enforcement kind of sedan, so I was like, okay, some kind of federal surveillance. And then a few days later, I put my trash out the night before because I'd miss the trash man if I tried to do it in the morning. I go to work, I walk out, go to get in my car. I was like, let me check the trash. Walk over, open it, no trash. So walk over to my neighbor's trash can, open it, there's trash. So walk over to my other neighbor's trash can, open it, and there's trash. It's like, okay, this is a repeat occurrence. So I wasn't doing anything wrong. There wasn't anything in my trash that was incriminating, but for some reason, somebody wanted to check me out. Some more indicators of whether you might be under surveillance. If you see suspicious people or vehicles in different places. I saw that car at the store, now I'm seeing it at the post office and outside my office. Yeah, that you might be under surveillance. If people know things about you that they shouldn't, or know about your business activities when they shouldn't, somebody's probably got some kind of surreptitious monitoring of you. If somebody's asking questions about you, obviously. If somebody breaks into your car or house, but everything's still there, it might have been to set up some surveillance. If you notice some electrical wall plates moved, notice some strange sounds on your telephone, beeps, whatever, it could be monitored. Or if you notice sounds coming from your handset when it's hung up. Your phone rings and you hear a tone or no one is there. It could be somebody just messing with you, but you never know. Your radio or television starts getting strange interference. Your car radio makes strange sounds. Car audio surveillance will definitely mess with your car radio. So if you start having problems with your car radio, you might want to check out your car. You see little small discolorations, you know, putty's been applied to your walls or ceiling. Somebody just gave you a gift, an electronic device. We're going to go through some electronic devices that are pretty interesting in a few minutes. Your smoke detector or lamp looks a little crooked or suddenly has a small hole in it or something. Certain items appear in your office or home. Nobody knows where they came from. Or you see dust, drywall dust on your floor. Maybe somebody's been drilling in your wall for some reason while you aren't home. If you think it can't happen, you're wrong. You see ceiling tile or grit on the floor, the desk. I've seen that at work a few times. And, yeah, I mean, you know, at work you have no privacy. Your employer will install a camera over your cubicle in a heartbeat if they feel like it. You see utility workers spending a lot of time around your house. People show up to check things out when you didn't call them and report a problem. You see trucks parked by, but nobody seems to be in them. If your door locks start feeling a little different, maybe somebody broke in and you just don't know it. You know, your furniture's been moved around or your things seem to be out of place. So, those are the warning signs, you know. So let's look at some pretty cool, interesting little tools that are used for investigation. Here's a lie detector phone. The little tools we're going to go through, these are like the professional stuff. You can get these cheaper, but they're not as good. So these are kind of high priced, and the prices are averaged. But this is just some interesting stuff that's out there that you need to be aware of. This can do, you know, lie detection and record your conversations, about $200. Here's a voice changer, you know, great for social engineering, identity spoofing. You know, you can be several different people for about $100. Wireless video sunglasses. I couldn't afford these, but they're kind of neat. $1,300. Video pen, $500. Wireless video, pretty inconspicuous. This Thai camera housed in stylish Italian ties. Well, stylish is a relative term, but I think they're damn ugly. But that's how they were marketed. $275. VCR camera, there are plenty of these available. I thought this one was kind of neat because it does time-lapse motion recording, so you can get tons of hours without changing your tape, where others you have to change the tapes often. But you know, there are a lot of those types available. Clock radio camera. Yeah, it works. It's a clock. It's a radio. It's a wireless camera. $350. So that's what I was talking about earlier. If somebody gives you an electronic device as a gift, you know, I don't know. Book camera. It's kind of interesting. You just sit it on the shelf, $200, and start recording. Hopefully nobody wants to read the book. Make it something really boring of a title. This Teddy cam, inconspicuous if you put it in a girl's room or a little kid's room. If you put it in my room, I'm going to burn it in effigy. About $200. So you won't get any video of me with that in my room because it'll be gone real quick. These are like the latest thing that's out there. I think it's pretty neat. Cell phone camera. And very inconspicuous. Everybody carries a cell phone. Some of these will act as a phone and a camera. Others just act as a camera. So if you have one of these and somebody says, hey, can I use your cell phone? It's like, I'm over my minutes and I can't afford it. So, you know, you bring these in interesting use, you know, bring it to your local strip club. And it's like, you can relive that table dance over and over and over. and strippers would hate me for saying that. Not that I go to those places, but pager cam. Well, not that many people carry pagers anymore, but these things are available. You can do covert snapshots, about $200. A little spy light, UV light, for looking at stuff in a dark room without being detected. It's pretty cheap, $16. Here's some Cold War technology, a night vision monocular, $275. Pretty neat if you want to do some nighttime surveillance. I thought this was really neat, a peephole spy. So you put this up to somebody's door peephole and just reverse the view so you can see inside the house just the way they would see outside. The price to me is a little crazy. I think I could probably make this for $10. So, but they market it for like $160. Pen recorder, 8 hours digital recording time, voice activated, very inconspicuous, $300. A laser listening device, more Cold War technology. This, you know, you can listen to a conversation from pretty far away, $350. It's a lot more sophisticated than the next listening device, which is the parabolic dish. We've all seen these, about $200. Surface microphone, stick this up to a regular wall or a concrete wall and you know, crank it up and you can hear what's going on inside a building, about $180, or a home, building or home. Lockpick set. I'm sure some of you have seen some lockpicking demonstrations here, and we've seen lockpick sets that are a lot cheaper. Well, this is a pretty big set, so I don't know, it's $50 for that one. The quick set lock pull. The quick set lock is the most widely used lock in the world, and the way it's marketed is it removes the core quickly and silently, enabling you to carry out repairs on the lock. It's illegal to market these things to be used for illegal purposes, so they have to come up with creative marketing ideas for these, and that's just one example. $90 for that. Here's, you know, if you're hardcore and, you know, you're going to be doing some serious lock busting, you might want to invest in this 27 caliber gun. It'll penetrate any lock set up to 3 inches thick, has interchangeable breaching modules. It's kind of pricey, but if you do this routinely, it might be worth the investment. And it doesn't make a bang like a gun, even though it is a gun. It's like a gun with a silencer, but obviously when you bang into a 3-inch piece of metal, that's going to make some sound, but you won't have that plus the gunshot. This is really interesting to me. It's a keystroke logger. You basically unplug somebody's keyboard and plug this in and then plug it back in their tower.
Yeah. Just saw it advertised for $70
PC guy. Okay, well, the prices have come down since my research. And you don't need to put any software on your target box, and basically, you know, it won't pick up email that somebody views, but it'll pick up email that somebody types. Somebody boots up, the first thing they do is log in, so it'll pick up your login. If you type in any URLs, if you just point and click on something, it won't pick up that, but it'll store about 32 text pages. Then you go back later, you pull this off, and you bring it to your machine that has the software that can strip off those text pages. So you don't need any logical access to your target machine. Here's some commercial software. Runs on Windows and Mac, does keystroke logging, email, chat room, instant messenger, and web surfing logs, about $100. You'd obviously need access to the machine to install the software first. If you want to tail somebody without tailing them, this GPS tracking device. You just stick it on whatever you want to tail, and then you can sit at home and view on the web everywhere that that device goes, so that later on you can set up surveillance at those points. It's pretty pricey, but it's a top-of-the-line product. What else might one need if they're doing private investigation? Fake IDs, work badges, diplomas, law enforcement, passports. I've seen these. I've seen the actual products. You can get all of this stuff for, you know, roughly $200, and it's super high quality. Even the police badges and, you know, can be used for some interesting social engineering. So those are like spy tools. I didn't really want to get into counter surveillance, but there were a few interesting things I wanted to show you. This is an acoustic noise generator, and they use these in classified facilities to prevent outsiders from recording inside conversations. So it basically overwhelms the area with white noise around the walls and stuff. And you'll hear people say, oh, we piped in music around our windows in this classified room. Well, they don't pipe in music. They use those. A radio frequency detector. You basically scan for different RF frequencies and can detect hidden microphones that are sending transmissions to someone who's recording them. About $350. Phone line analyzer to detect wiretaps on your phone. I could probably talk for an hour on wiretaps, different types of phone wiretaps, and ways to detect them. It gets really complex. You know, the point is, this won't detect all the tap methods, but it'll detect the common ones. $280. Here's a defensive weapon for dumpster diver that Acid Burn used with Zero Cool in the movie Hackers. Anyway, that was just a joke, but I thought that was an interesting counter-surveillance weapon. Yeah. So, important laws to be aware of. I'm way over on time. The economic espionage, well, actually, that clock's not even right. It's still on my time back elsewhere. Economic Espionage Act of 1996. You know, if you're going to do any of these methodologies that we've discussed, you better make sure you understand the laws so you don't cross the line, or, you know, what could happen if you do. Up to 15 years in prison, $10 million in fines. The thing is about espionage is the owner of the information must have taken reasonable precautionary measures to keep the information secret. If they leave it on a park bench and you pick it up, then you haven't committed a crime. The computer crime, the Title 18 U.S. Code 1030, this is the thing you see on all the login banners when you access systems. It's a federal crime if you access a system and remove or copy information, and that includes like writing it down or doing a screen snapshot or a session log, destruction of files. If you manipulate log files to cover your tracks, you've destroyed files. If you plant any back doors, you know, you've committed a federal crime. Penalties up to 10 years in prison. However, one interesting thing is if you access a computer and the only fraud is use of the computer and that use is less than $5,000 worth of CPU time in any 1 year, and you haven't copied information, all you've done is look around, you haven't really committed a crime. But if you're detected and an organization spends over $5,000 investigating that breach, then it becomes a federal crime again. So some states have enacted, you know, state laws that make simple trespass a crime. Texas, Michigan, California, Missouri, Georgia, Massachusetts, New York, and D.C. There's a variety of penalties. And, you know, I would strongly suggest people do research before they trespass. Dumpster diving, if you put your trash out by the curb, you have no expectation of privacy of that trash. But if trash is in a no trespassing marked area, then you're not supposed to go fool with it. If you do, then you've broken some trespassing laws or invasion of privacy laws. In some places, even if a trash collector picks it up from a area marked private, they can then turn it over to the police, you know, on public ground. So, wiretaps, if you illegally intercept an electronic communication, it's a federal crime. Doesn't matter what type of electronic communication. You can't use an electronic device to record oral communications. Penalties up to 5 years in jail and fines. Recording phone calls, same law applies. Some notable exceptions in 12, actually in all states except for 12, you can record with consent of at least one party. So if I'm talking to you and I consent that I want to record our conversation, I can record it. Except if you live in these 12 states, it requires both parties' consent. Businesses can monitor your phone calls at work, you know, by law, so you have no privacy at work. That's a well-established fact. The FCC has a companion regulation that says one of these three things has to occur when you're recording a phone conversation. So either both parties consent, or you give a verbal notification, or you have an electronic beep regularly. So if you've ever been on the phone with somebody and you hear like boop, and like, hey, is that your call waiting, and they're like, no, it must be yours, and it's like, I don't have it, you know, and then you hear beep again, dude, is that your call waiting? No. Well, it might be a recorded phone call. This is a different U.S. code, 2701. If you access illegally email or telegrams, it's a federal crime. It's up to 2 years in prison and civil action. Surveillance. Non-threatening observation in public areas is acceptable, but you can't trespass or you can't alter the environment to aid in your viewing. Penalties are civil invasion of privacy or harassment. So if you're on a public street or in a tree in a public park and you have a camera or a video recorder or an audio recorder, you can, you know, conduct surveillance. But if somebody detects your surveillance, you should break it off, because if you continue, they can claim harassment. So you should either break it off or modify it. Mail inspection, it's illegal to take people's mail. Penalties up to 5 years in jail. However, if you want to verify that someone lives at a certain address, you could open their mailbox and look at their mail, as long as you don't remove it out of the mailbox, to just verify that the name is who you think it is. Freedom of Information Act basically allows you to get any public government, any federal records on yourself. And if you spoof your identity, then you can get records on other people. There are some exclusions, you know, law enforcement investigations, confidential informant disclosure, and terrorism or espionage records. If you want to use the FOIA to get information on yourself from a particular government agency, you can call that 1-800 number and get officer contact information. I kind of suggest using that law to verify that information held by the federal government on you is accurate, because, you know, it'll amaze you how much information is held on you, especially if you've ever been a government employee. but even as a private citizen, a lot of government agencies are keeping data on you, but sometimes it's the wrong data. So it makes sense to check it out and make sure at least their records are accurate. So when they come after you for something that you wasn't even involved in, you have a chance to correct it before some misunderstanding takes place. According to the Privacy Act, any citizen can view and amend federally maintained information about themselves. And also with this act, government agencies can't use information for purposes other than that which it was collected. So if they collect your name and social, they have to say, we're using it to do this check, and that's the only check we're going to do. Now, here's some other laws of interest. If you're interested in this stuff, I suggest you check them out and just be aware of them. And basically, if you want to check out the full text of most of the laws that I covered, you can hit that URL. What have we learned? Hopefully we haven't all learned that, hey, we're real criminals and we've broken all those laws, but hopefully it's like, be aware of potential ramifications before you do some certain activities. Just know what the ground rules are. And then that wraps up the talk. And basically, what have I learned doing the research for this talk is that corporations, governments, and private citizens have no privacy. If people want to find out stuff about you and they're motivated, they will. And that being said, I thank everyone for coming and participating in this session. And if you have any questions, comments, or you want to throw lettuce at me, go ahead. What's up?
Does the FCC rule about the need of recording telephone conversations override the state's
Does the FCC's rule about the beep override the federal statute on... Well, the FCC is a federal regulation, so it does overrule the states, but it's only one of those three things has to occur. So it could be the beep, or it could be both persons' consent. Yes. No. It doesn't specify if you read the law. It does not specify what kind of beep. Yes. He's asking about the NIPC and InfraGuard, the National Information Protection Center and InfraGuard. I was on the board of directors of InfraGuard for a while, and it's interesting meetings, and it gives you face-to-face between organizations that may have attacks. If you meet some Sprint security officer, and I'm just using Sprint as an example, you work for some pharmaceutical company, and you meet the FBI agents, and you see an attack coming from the Sprint network. And I'm not using Sprint with any intent, but if you know the guy there, it's easier to call him, and he knows you, and you can say, hey, there's something suspicious coming from your network, and they're more likely to work with you. And if you've had some kind of introduction to the FBI, that also helps, because my first interactions with the FBI were not pleasant. It was because I was working somewhere and there were people, doing bad things, and it got to a point where the FBI had to be called in. But if they don't know you and, don't know what you're about, they will automatically make you the suspect along with whatever else is going on. And I had some really unpleasant conversations with some FBI agents. But, so if you've broken that ice, you might, not have that same kind of situation occur to you. But, what has it done to, like, harden the infrastructure? I don't think much, but... Well, yeah. Yeah, well, actually, InfraGuard does have alerts and advisories that they send out, daily stuff. It's just like the all the other security advisories. They get their information from the same sources. So if you subscribe to some of those security mailing lists, you'll get the same information, you know, 5 times a day. So if you only are a member of InfraGuard and you don't subscribe to those other services, it has, you know, that value. I mean, it has value. It's a good thing, but it's not been as productive as it could be in my eyes. Yes?
What do you recommend for keylogging?
For crypto, 1024, you know. The thing about, well, public key is obviously different from symmetric key. When you're talking about cryptography, based on my knowledge, there are backdoors into a lot of commercial cryptographic products. Random numbers and random values aren't always random. And you could have a 56-bit DES key, but if 40 of those bits are predictable, then you only have a 16-bit DES key. So that's what I've seen in commercial crypto systems. So. Yes. Differences between hardening against information warfare and hardening just like general corporate networks. For information warfare, and data labeling and data classification and mandatory access controls, where in corporate hardening, it might not be that critical of information to where if it's disclosed, you have losses of human life. You have losses of financial information or personal information, but you don't potentially have human losses. So it is a little bit tighter, and it needs to be. And Department of Defense takes it very seriously. Yes?
Yeah, fully on there that corporations are trying to be tapping the phone lines from the service provider?
No, they only have to use, like, phone company-supplied equipment. I would say it also applies to voice over IP. Yes.
Do you have a sense of how effective, let's say, law enforcement is at tracking back movements back to the person who did it? Do you have a feel for that? And is there a huge difference between, which agency is tracking?
A sense of how effective law enforcement is in identifying the source of an attack. Well, a source of an attack can involve other countries and often does. So typically, they'll have to work with, people in other countries and Scotland Yard and things of that nature. And if it's a continuous repeating attack, they'll track it down. If it's a one-time thing and the person who committed the attack was fairly smart about it, they'll get away with it a lot of times. Okay, well, I thank you. Yes? My email address? Yeah, right there at the bottom.
Thank you.
So, thank you.